From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Horror is everywhere. Just pick up a newspaper or watch cable news. They're full of murder and mayhem. The entertainment industry is churning out movies like Paranormal Activity 3 and TV shows like American Horror Story. The bestseller list is dominated by books about vampires and zombies and serial killers. And now, horror's even invaded public radio. Well, this hour anyway. Today, the story of how a few eccentric outsiders gave us nightmares, conquered Hollywood, and invented the modern horror movie. Celebrated film director John Landis talks about monster movies, and we explore the philosophy of horror and the art of cruelty. Colson Whitehead grew up watching Twilight Zone reruns, reading Marvel comics, and watching horror movies on cable TV. It was the modern master of horror fiction, Stephen King, who inspired Whitehead to become a writer. No surprise, then, that Whitehead's new novel, Zone One, is about zombies. Here's an excerpt.
He was the first live human being the dead had seen since the start. And the former ladies of HR were starving. After all this time, they were a thin membrane of meat stretched over bone. Their skirts were bunched on the floor, having slid off their shrunken hips long ago, and the dark jackets of their sensible dress suits were made darker still and stiffened by jagged arterial splashes and kernels of gore. Two of them had lost their high heels at some point during the long years of bumping around the room looking for an exit. One of them wore the same brand of panties his last two girlfriends had favored, with the distinctive frilled red edges. They were grimed and torn. He couldn't help but notice the thong, current demands on his attention aside. He'd made a host of necessary recalibrations, but the old self made noises from time to time. Then that new self stepped in. He had to put them down. The youngest one wore its hair in a style popularized by a sitcom that took as its subject three roommates of seemingly immiscible temperaments and their attempts to make their fortune in this contusing city. A crotchety super and a flamboyant neighbor rounded out the ensemble, and it was still appointment television, a top 10 show, at the time of the disaster. The hairdo was called a Marge, after Margaret Halstead, the charmingly klutzy actress who trademarked it in the old days of red carpets and flirty tete-a-tetes on late-night chat shows. She hadn't done anything for Mark Spitz, too skinny, but the legions of young ladies who fled their stunted towns to reinvent themselves in the big city recognized something in her flailings and fetishized this piece of her. They had been reeled in by the old lie of making a name for oneself in the city. Now they had to figure out how to survive. Hunt and gather rent money, forage ramen. In this week's written-up clubs and small-plate eateries, loose flocks of Marges were invariably underfoot, sipping cinnamon-rimmed novelty cocktails and laughing too eagerly. The Marge nabbed Mark Spitz first, snatching his left bicep and taking it in its teeth. It never looked at his face, ferocious on the mesh of his fatigues and aware exclusively of the meat it knew was underneath. He'd forgotten how much it hurt when a skell tried to get a good chomp going. It had been some time since one had gotten this close. The Marge couldn't penetrate the intricate blend of plastic fibers, but each rabid sally sent him howling. The rest of Omega Team would be here soon, tromping down the halls. He heard the sound of teeth splintering. The sweepers were supposed to stay together, the lieutenant was firm about that, to prevent this very situation. But the last few blocks had been so quiet, they hadn't stuck to orders.
Colson Whitehead, reading an excerpt from his new novel, Zone One. He tells Steve Paulson the book was inspired by a bad dream.
I had some house guests out in Long Island. I guess I was in a bad mood, so I woke up one morning and I heard them chatting and making bacon. The only thing I could think was, can you guys leave? I want to be alone. And of course, I'd invited them, so it would have been rude to say anything. And these are people I loved very much. Instead, I just willed myself back to sleep and had a dream. I was in my apartment in New York. I wanted to go into the living room, but I kept having this thought, have they swept out the zombies yet? So I woke up and I thought, yeah, actually, that's sort of a logistical nightmare. How do you get the shambling dead out of the city when you want to restart civilization? They linger like house guests who won't leave. And I started working on the book that day.
Wow. So what is it about zombies that you find scary?
For me, it's the fear or the suspicion that everyone you know is really a monster underneath the veneer of civilization. So at any moment, your family, your friends, the kindly shopkeeper down the street could be transformed into the horrible creature they've always been. So that was my interpretation. Obviously, I have psychological problems. But I got a book out of it, so what are you going to do?
Can you tell me about the storyline of your new book, Zone One?
Going back to the dream, how do you clear out the zombies when things are trying to get back to normal? So the zombie apocalypse, the plague, has ravaged the world, but it's going away. It's run its course, and America is rebuilding society. There are settlement camps up and down the eastern seaboard, and now they have the idea for a new initiative, which is to resettle Manhattan. It's an island. You can block off the tunnels and bridges and go block by block, clearing out the remainders of the dead. That sounds like a nice title, The Remainders of the Dead. So the army has gone through clearing out Zone One, which is everything below Canal. There's a wall that separates the tamed and untamed sections of the city. And now civilian teams are going through restaurant to restaurant, corporate tower to corporate tower, clearing out the plague-stricken wretches that the army has left behind, things that are trapped in utility closets or whatever. So the book follows 3 days in the life of one sweeper named Mark Spitz. It's a nickname. And eventually things start breaking down, unfortunately.
Hmm. Now, we should mention also that you have two different kinds of zombies in your book, although you actually never use the word zombie to describe these creatures, but there are the Skells and the Stragglers. What's the difference between them?
The Skells are your conventional slow-moving zombie that we know from popular culture. And then the Stragglers are something I added. I mean, they're basically ghosts. I think when you approach a genre, you want to stick with some conventions, and you want to reinvigorate it. You want to pay homage to what's gone before, but also expand the idea of what a detective novel is, a romance is, you know, a horror novel is. So my little variation is the Stragglers. And the Stragglers are malfunctioning zombies. They're emotionally connected to some place in their lives. And when they get infected, they head there like homing pigeons and then stay rooted in the place that they're connected to. So if you were a shrink, you might go to your office and then sit on your lounger and wait for patients who are dead, never coming. If you're a radio host, you might head to the studio and put on your headphones and wait for the dead engineer to start things up. And so these people are trapped in their rooms across downtown Manhattan, and the sweepers are going to take out this sort of very innocuous variety of zombie.
Hmm. One thing that's striking about your book is that there often doesn't seem to be that much difference between the living and the dead. The survivors, as you've said, Mark Spitz is kind of dehumanized in his own way. I assume that was a deliberate choice?
Yes. The survivors are all still stuck in their old modes. And so I thought that the bad things would come back quickly. All the sort of bad stuff of contemporary society would reemerge before any innovation. So bureaucracy, corporate branding, our need for fresh organic produce, which is not necessarily bad, but it's a feature of our lives. So all the sort of contemporary features that we love, adore, and hate today, we'll usher them back into existence pretty quickly.
What's so interesting hearing you describe your book is, on the one hand, it's a great story, you know, it's a horror story. But you're also raising some pretty big questions about what it means to be human, what dehumanizes us, and kind of how precarious, how vulnerable being human is.
For me, that's the heart of it. It's about coming back from a disaster, not necessarily the apocalypse, but a disaster in your personal life. Someone dies, you're close to, you lose your job. There's a before and an after, and you have to figure out this new landscape, this new self, walking around in these new conditions. And so for me, it's about survivors, about moving on and figuring out how to move on, make new connections with people. And zombies are a rhetorical prop. The end of the world is a way of making these personal disasters global.
Colson Whitehead is the author of Zone One. He spoke with Steve Paulson. You can find a link to Colson Whitehead's website at ttbook.org. You'll also find a link to our Facebook page there. Coming up, the story of how a few outsiders gave us new cinematic nightmares. And director John Landis on Monsters in the Movies as we continue our Hour on Horror. And Jim Fleming, it's to the best of our knowledge, from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin System eCampus, providing access to online degree programs and certificates offered by the 26 campuses of the UW system. Information is at ecampus.wisconsin.edu.
Jason Zinnemann is a theater critic and reporter for the New York Times. He's also the author of Shock Value, How a Few Eccentric Outsiders Gave Us Nightmares, Conquered Hollywood, and Invented Modern Horror. The book chronicles the careers of directors like Wes Craven and John Carpenter, who revolutionized horror movies during the 1970s. Zinnemann calls their approach the new horror to distinguish it from the old horror populated by vampires and werewolves. What else is different?
There is an increased emphasis on realism. And I think you could simplify the horror genre into two strains, which is one, which is a kind of surreal strain, and one, which is a realistic strain. And realism, informed by cinema verite and documentary and news reports, became much more common, both in the form, the way that they were shot. They kind of had the look of a grittier, more handheld feel, but also in the content, that it wasn't about a werewolf and a vampire. The horror was located in the prom queen and going to the beach and a little girl, you know, next door. So they were very relatable horrors. So that's one thing. I think the second thing is the horror became much more disorienting. There were many more unhappy endings or unexplained kinds of evil. What I argue in the book is that a lot of these directors were influenced by this one writer, H.P. Lovecraft, who said that the oldest and strongest emotion in mankind is fear, and the strongest kind, I'm paraphrasing here, the strongest kind of fear is fear of the unknown. And I think that's a very profound statement and probably the most important sentence ever written about the horror genre, and explains a lot of what these directors of this period understood about what scares us. Lessons that I think are surprisingly many directors since have forgotten.
One of the things that people think about when they look at the development of new horror films was how much, as you say, more real they were, but also how much more blood there was, how much more perception of violence as something in our lives rather than removed from our lives.
Yes, definitely. Gore and graphic violence was not invented in this period, but it was certainly increased. And also, I think there was a political edge to it. There was a sense that, among some people like Wes Craven, that the news media wasn't showing the violence in Vietnam. And so, of course, he was making an exploitation film, but he's also has a political point to this violence, which is to show you the ugliness of violence. The other major change is in the monster. Until this point, the horror monsters, largely established by the classic Universal movies, were vampires, werewolves, ghosts. So what happened in this period is that Romero's version of this flesh-eating zombie that's going to take over the world was introduced, and the serial killer became probably the dominant monster of the period. So those were huge shifts, and the serial killer clearly was not a supernatural figure, although he had sometimes had elements of it. When you had your main monster who wasn't a supernatural figure, it could be somebody who was much more ordinary and realistic.
Yeah, somebody who could be in your life.
In a lot of ways, horror films are not about narrative, clearly. Like, there's often very simple narratives. Some movies, that's not true, but I think the interesting narrative in a lot of these movies has to do with the development of the point of view. I mean, a movie like Halloween is a classic example. There's a story about the stalker stalking babysitters, but it's not that interesting. The real narrative of the movie is how John Carpenter, the director, shifts the point of view from the point of view of the killer to the point of view of the victim to the point of view of the observer. That's the really fascinating thing. It's dizzying for the audience member.
Halloween was one of the most successful horror films, one of the most successful films ever made, I suppose. Did it really change things?
You could make an argument that Halloween is the most imitated movie of all time, which is incredible when you consider it was made in like a month on a tiny budget. It didn't have a national release. It began in city to city. But it has spawned so many imitators. A lot of what my book tries to do is look at where some of the key elements of Halloween come from. And I think I uncover a lot of things that haven't been out there through reporting. But I think, you know, the key elements are this point of view shot. It wasn't the first director to show from the killer's point of view, but he popularized it. He wasn't the first director to have a killer with a mask, but he certainly popularized it. What a lot of people took from it was this sort of getting killed after having sex, teenager having sex, this kind of body count movies, which there is a long tradition of in Italian horror, particularly the decade before. The real innovation of Halloween, which ironically hasn't been ripped off as much, is actually the killer, Michael Myers, because Michael Myers was a human being, but he was also not really. He didn't really walk like a human being or move like a human being. He didn't run. He seemed to be everywhere at once. He had no psychology. He had no backstory. His kills, he seemed to take no pleasure from or do for any reason at all. And what's interesting is that Carpenter strenuously establishes this very naturalistic landscape of an ultimately ordinary suburban America and then puts inside this world this incredibly avant-garde, experimental, weird kind of anti-character.
I met this six-year-old child with this blank, pale, emotionless face and the blackest eyes, the devil's eyes. I spent 8 years trying to reach him, and then another 7 trying to keep him locked up because I realized that what was living behind that boy's eyes was purely and simply evil.
I think the horror of Halloween is in how unexplainable Michael Myers is. And a lot of filmmakers have since figured this out, and I think you see it in a movie like No Country for Old Men. But the immediate imitators, like the Friday the 13th series and all the slash series in the 80s, did not choose to single that part out.
There's another part of it that you write about that's fascinating. You say that music played a key part in Halloween's success, right?
Huge. In fact, if I was to write this book again, if there was one thing I would really beef up, I think, is the role of sound design.
Well, what was so different about this one that brought so much to your attention?
Carpenter wrote a classic synthesizer soundtrack to announce the killer coming, which is as well known as the John Williams music to announce the shark in Jaws. The way movies are today is that you make the movie and then people put the music to correlate to the scene. And the way the Carpenter music plays is almost like the movie sort of fits around the music. And just the sound of it is chilling. And anyone who hears it now, and you see it pop up in movies all the time.
It was, what, 1979 when Alien came out, that science fiction horror film that is probably better known in some ways than the others, and maybe taken more seriously. The screenplay was written by a film school friend of John Carpenter's, Dan O'Bannon. Can you tell us about him?
Yeah, Dan O'Bannon, I think, you know, in a lot of ways, he is the least well-known figure who I read about, and his legacy, I think, you know, it's something that I'm most proud of, the fact that I got this story into this book, especially before he passed away, because he's a major figure and he's been undervalued for a lot of reasons that have to do with politics, I believe. You know, I think the key decisions that went into Alien, and you're right, I think Alien is in some ways the one, you know, the greatest horror movie of this period, that and Chainsaw, and certainly had a huge impact, that the really key decisions were made by O'Bannon. One is the chest burster scene, which is the most famous scene in horror since the shower psycho scene. Two, he hired the Swiss designer Giger to design the monster, which was a really unpredictable move at the time, that this was a guy who had no experience in Hollywood movies. The monster in Alien was unlike any that had been seen before. You know, if you look at the costumes in the Lady Gaga concert, they're patterned after the alien monster. Has had a huge impact on gothic culture, and you know, the weird kind of sexual imagery that's in that monster is totally different than has been seen before. And I think there was a certain kind of Lovecraftian element in that movie, and the sense that the first victim was a man. The imagery was man was raped. You know, the alien kind of impregnated him, and then it came out. That was very different than most of the horror victims at the time.
Well, and one of the things you write about that makes it actually even more horrifying in retrospect, because I don't think anybody knew this at the time, was the source of the idea for that horrible scene when the alien bursts out. Can you tell us about that?
It's very tragic because Dan O'Bannon passed away, but he passed away because he had suffered with Crohn's disease, and he struggled with this and tried to keep it quiet because he thought it would hurt his career, but he struggled with a really extreme stomach pain his whole life. What I love about this, and I find this again and again, is that, you know, the source of this incredibly famous and wonderful scene is personal. Oftentimes people who talk about, you know, the political implications of the horror, or they're doing it for commercial reasons. But again and again, if you look at these movies, if you look at where Wes Craven's interest comes from, if you look at where Dan O'Bannon's, is that it's like, you know, any other artist that gets the proper respect. You know, Eugene O'Neill's plays, his best plays come from personal things in his life. These directors, when they tried to come up with the scariest thing they could, they would root around in their mind to what really, really terrified them. And this is something that was a day-to-day concern. Something is brewing inside my stomach and wants to get out. And he came up with this incredible scene for me.
Don't touch it!
Jason Zinnemann is the author of Shock Value: How a Few Eccentric Outsiders Gave Us Nightmares, Conquered Hollywood, and Invented Modern Horror. What did the movies National Lampoon's Animal House, The Blues Brothers, and An American Werewolf in London have in common? Well, besides being among the most popular movies ever released, they were all directed by John Landis. Landis has just released an appropriately monstrous-sized book called Monsters in the Movies, 100 Years of Cinematic Nightmares. To the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon got together with him recently to talk about monsters in the movies.
How would John Landis define a monster?
Monsters are things that we fear. And what do we really fear? And I think that what humans fear the most is what they don't know. As a species, we have difficulty with the concept. It's very much like the way our law is set up in this country, where if there's an accident, it must be someone's fault. You know, there has to be some way to find fault. There's a reason for this accident, because the concept of an accident is too damn terrifying. And since we don't know what happens once we're dead, that's unacceptable. So we create religions and philosophies and zombies and vampires and ghouls and ghosts, all kinds of things. So we're not dead. We're undead. Monsters are just essential to humans. From the most primitive cave paintings to the most sophisticated digital technologies, we're still just drawing pictures of monsters.
What kind of monsters scare John Landis?
I'm not frightened by fantasy monsters or the supernatural. I'm terrified by people. I actually have a chapter in there on human monsters. Famous psychotics in films like Hannibal Lecter or Norman Bates, or brilliant performance by Christian Bale in American Psycho.
In 87, Huey released this, Four, their most accomplished album. I think their undisputed masterpiece is Hip to Be Square. A song so catchy, most people probably don't listen to the lyrics, but they should, because it's not just about the pleasures of conformity and the importance of trends, it's also a personal statement about the band itself. Hey, Paul! Ah!
Toby Hooper's Texas Chainsaw Massacre, because these people, cannibals, pederasts, serial killers, are real.
I asked Landis if making a monster more human makes it less scary.
I don't think monsters necessarily have to be scary. I don't think scary is a necessary definition of a monster. In Beauty and the Beast, the Cocteau film, the Beast is magnificent and incredibly attractive. In fact, the end, he turns into the prince, Jean Marius, the actor. He's such a disappointment. Garbo famously said when she saw the movie, she said, "Bring back my beast!" King Kong is a victim. Here's this guy on an island that we drag in chains to Manhattan. The Frankenstein monster, the genius of Karloff's performance is He didn't ask to be created. He's just a bunch of meat sewed together, and he's abused. Yes, he can be frightening, and he is, but he's a victim. And in terms of the werewolf as victim, that's new. That was invented by a screenwriter, Kurt Seelenmach, who wrote The Wolfman. Up until that point, werewolves had always been associated with witches and warlocks and were evil. Dracula, in the book, can turn himself into a wolf. The big bad wolf in the original French fairy tale is basically a warlock, and he ends up eating Little Red Riding Hood. But in The Wolfman, Seelenmach treated the curse of being a werewolf as a disease. You know, there's the famous how Lon Chaney Jr. keeps waking up somewhere, going, "What happened last night?" The Wolfman is literally other. It's like getting cancer. It's not him. It's a disease. He's a victim. And that was relatively new invention.
In 1981, Landis made his own contribution to monster movies with the critically acclaimed box office hit An American Werewolf in London. The inspiration for the film came in 1969, when an 18-year-old Landis was working as a production assistant in what was then Yugoslavia. He and his boss, Sasha, were driving along when they had to stop on a wooden road.
There was a group of gypsies, about 25 people. And first of all, they were so surprising to me because they looked like dress extras. They really did. They're like, oh, gypsies, with babushkas and the whole thing. And there were two Greek Orthodox priests with incense and all this stuff. And Sasha pointed, and on the ground was a body. And the body had been wrapped in a shroud. And the shroud was wrapped in garlands of garlic and rosaries. And we thought, what is going on here? And they dug a hole. And they were burying this body, feet first, in this hole, upright. He'd committed some crime, and they were taking these very elaborate precautions so that the body would not get up and cause trouble. And about 2 weeks before this, we'd landed a man on the moon. And I was thinking, and these people are worried about zombies. Sasha just thought it was hysterical, and he kept giggling and making jokes. But what was fascinating to me, I thought about it later, and I thought, you know, what if I, you know, that night we cut back, full moon, camera moves in. I actually did that shot in Thriller later. Camera moves in, and you see fingers digging their way toward the surface, and this body, this dead man, pulls himself out of the ground. Now, if I was standing there with my friend, how would I react? What would I do? How would I react? I thought, I wouldn't know how to react. I have no conditioning, no training to deal with The Walking Dead. And see how you laughed? That's what we do. What sophisticated or educated people tend to do with the supernatural is giggle. That's why American Werewolf was funny, because I was trying to make it as realistic as possible. It was about two guys who was basically representing me and my friend Greg when we were 18, confronted with something fantastic that could not be happening, and it is happening, and it is happening to them.
An American Werewolf in London features an incredibly graphic transformation scene. The scene earned special makeup effects artist Rick Baker the first Academy Award for Best Makeup.
I was very lucky to have Rick Baker, who was brilliant. He had a difficult task because I wrote that it took place in bright light, and there were no lap dissolves. It used to be, you know, the traditional Wolfman transformation. Lon Chaney Jr. would assume a position, and then they would do a makeup, and then they'd film some more, and then they'd do a makeup and film some more. So all the Wolfman transitions tend to be rather gentle. And I thought, if your body's actually going to transform, metamorphosize into something different, it's going to hurt. And so I wanted it to be painful, and I wanted you to see it. Luckily for me, I had Rick Baker, and he accomplished that.
I asked Landis what the scariest movie of all time is.
So much of a film experience has to do with how old you are and who you are when you see it. I saw The Exorcist. I think that's the last movie I stood in line over an hour for. And I saw it with two guys, Jim O'Rourke and George Folsey, both of whom were lapsed Catholics, and both had been altar boys. and I'm, you know, a secular Jew, and we go to see this movie. The hype was so intense, people vomiting into theater, and it was such a big hit, it was such a sensation, that I'll never forget being in a theater in Westwood here in Los Angeles, in about a 1,400-seat house called The National, which is no longer there. It was packed with people, and the suspense was palpable in the house. And, you know, the lights went down, and everybody went, oh! I mean, they were terrified before it started. And then watching the movie, that is a great example, that's William Friedkin, of suspension of disbelief, which is what a filmmaker's trying to do. Well, anybody, a painter, a novelist, everyone's trying to do that, but the suspension of disbelief. And I'm an atheist. During the course of that movie, I bought it all. I mean, I always thought the Pope should give Friedkin a medal for that picture, you know? Just terrifying. I just thought, oh my God, I mean, scared me to death. When the picture was finished, the three of us went out for coffee, talked about it, and I went home and slept like a baby. But George and Jim had nightmares for months, you know?
Oh, make it stop! He's gonna kill me! Mother! Oh, make it
stop! All right, let's see what to do.
Keep away!
The sour is mine!
His fellow filmmaker Guillermo del Toro told Landis that horror films are a roller coaster of the soul. What does John Landis think of that description?
I think it's fabulous. You know, it's a wonderful turn of phrase. I'm not sure exactly what it means, but...
Maybe that's part of the beauty of it, though.
Well, that's the beauty of Guillermo. Guillermo del Toro, who I adore, is one of the great talkers of all time.
John Landis is a film director and the author of Monsters in the Movies, 100 Years of Cinematic Nightmares. He spoke with, to the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon. Do you have a favorite movie monster or all-time scariest film? We'd love to know what it is. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. You'll also find a link to our Facebook page there. Coming up, we'll look at the art of cruelty and explore the philosophy of horror as we conclude our Hour on Horror. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Why do we enjoy horror? I mean, when you think about it, isn't there something a little sick about the way we find entertainment value in cruelty? Maggie Nelson's the author of several books of poetry, criticism, and memoir. Her latest book is called The Art of Cruelty, A Reckoning. In the book, Nelson explores the images of torture, horror, and endless warfare that inhabit our political and entertainment landscape. She talked with Steve Paulson about the French dramatist Antonin Artaud and his ideas about the relationship between art and cruelty.
He coined the term theater of cruelty in the 30s, in the theater and its double, and he was interested in kind of following Nietzsche in a way and pushing this idea of cruelty beyond necessarily its connotation of sadism or brutality and into a kind of theater of the senses, in which he imagined it would be the end of all psychological theater, you know, the end of kitchen sink theater, the end of kind of theater where you were able to leave and say, oh, you know, discuss character motivation or talk about how moved you were, but what really would have theater be an immersive experience for the senses.
So he wanted to jolt you. He wanted to sort of shock you out of your complacency and, I don't know, transform you in some way.
Absolutely, which is a very prototypical, you know, avant-garde attitude toward the arts. And I think Artaud, I compare him, as he's often compared, with Brecht. Brecht had a more concrete political effects he would like to achieve with whatever jolts or stylistic devices that Brecht wanted to use in the theater. Artaud was a madman.
Literally a madman, right?
Yes, literally, quite literally. And he had much more as a goal a kind of transformation of consciousness. As Susan Sontag says, you can do many things with Artaud, but you cannot apply him. So trying to apply his ideas about this jolt that he would hope that you would get, trying to apply them to, you know, that would make us better people, or would make for a better theater, or it would make for a more just social order. None of those cause-effect equations held for Artaud. He was really after a sensation and experience.
What did he mean by cruelty, though? What would be some examples of that?
It's a good question because, as I say in this chapter, Theaters of Cruelty, he was really at pains both in his manifestos and in his letters to differentiate the word cruelty from simple sadism or violence or bloodshed. He called it nothing less or nothing more than the appetite for life. He was kind of renaming the life force, a kind of, as he called it, an implacable necessity.
I have to say that that's sort of an odd way to think about the life force as
right, indeed, right?
that has to involve cruelty. Why does it?
You've just named the whole, you know, question of this chapter. Why violence? I mean, this is actually one of the big questions of the book. Why so many humans, Artaud only one among them, have remained infatuated by this idea that something about violence or something about a kind of extramural cruelty would have a particular capacity to deliver us, you know, either beyond good and evil or to deliver us into this very strong felt experience of what being alive was about. I don't partake in that personally. I find it very confusing, as it sounds like perhaps you do as well.
So to think about this in our own time, do you think someone like Artaud, who is, you know, very much a figure of the avant-garde, has he had much influence on current entertainment and maybe even current politics?
Oh, gosh. I don't think necessarily current politics, although the phrase theater of cruelty is very applicable to many aspects of our political system and the workings of our political world, but I don't think necessarily in the way that Artaud would have meant. At one point in my book, I Google theater of cruelty, and this was, you know, a few years ago. The first hit was to Abu Ghraib, an article in The Nation calling them our theater of cruelty, and the second hit was to American Idol, calling American Idol a theater of cruelty. So that kind of gave, a pretty good panoply of where the term had landed in, by, you know, at least 2003 or 2005. You know, Artaud was tapping into a carnivalesque tradition, and he was also very interested in Native American rituals and all kinds of things, and drug use, and I think festivals like Burning Man and a lot of performance art in the 60s. The Viennese Actionists are a very extreme group. Much performance art, any kind of immersive, experiential, to some extent, you know, some of the things going on with Occupy Wall Street, they're not Artaud related in Theater of Cruelty, but I think that
they're in your face, though.
Yeah, I mean, in your face, I was more thinking not so much about the in-your-face element as the disinterest in demands as much as in trying to give an example of how we might live differently.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about one of the most provocative examples of that, which you write about in your book. There was a performance piece by Chris Burden called Shoot in 1971. First of all, can you describe what happened in that piece?
Sure. The piece Shoot, which is probably one of Burden's most famous pieces, was a piece in which he was curious, that's his word, he was curious about what it would feel like to be shot, and he arranged an event in a gallery with invited onlookers to come and had a friend shoot a gun at his arm from across the gallery and shot him in the arm.
This was then put on film. I mean, it raises the obvious question, why in the world would he ask a friend to shoot him with a rifle?
A lot of the discussion around the piece Shoot had to do with, you know, whether or not this kind of act could be called art. I mean, many, many things in the 60s and 70s that were aiming to push at, well, way before that with, you know, the futurists, whoever, in the, you know, turn of the century. But certainly in the 60s and 70s, a lot of performance art, the question was more often circulated around, you know, is this art or how can this be called art? I mean, the piece Shoot, and I talk about this in my book, cruelty poses a particular challenge when there's something that is cruel to oneself versus something cruel that one does to another, per se. So the issue of consent.
So one question, then, an ethical question, is why would his friend consent to shoot him?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think in my book I do a lot of work to try and think harder about certain kinds of issues of what we might call shooting an act of self-harm. There are a lot of different forms of self-harm in art and otherwise, that if the person is wanting it to be done to them, and there are a lot of questions that get raised about who and why and when would it be appropriate to step in and not do to a body what it would like to have done to it.
We've been talking about art and the art of cruelty, and I want to sort of broaden this discussion to see what this might have to do with love, because you quote the poet William Carlos Williams. There's a poem, The Ivory Crown, where he has the line, "The business of love is cruelty, which by our wills we transform to live together." What do you make of that?
For a while when I was researching this book, I was pulling together different lines of poetry and other comments that might serve as good epigraphs or good food for thought for me for this project. And that one, "The business of love is cruelty, which by our wills we transform to live together," by Williams, it had always stuck in my mind and I had always liked it. I was troubled by it the more I looked at it closely, because there's a chapter in the book called "Who We Are," which is really about different contentions that are made. I think of them as very strategic. I don't think any of them can hold water at the end of the day. A lot of contentions that, you know, humans are essentially cruel or essentially good, or, you know, that compassion is at the bottom of our souls versus, you know, a kind of, you know, general sinfulness or wickedness or these different notions. I don't find those generalizations very useful in thinking about the human condition. And I think that that's part of the reason why the Williams quote, it drags through the book, because when I had first read it, it seemed like it meant a lot to me. And then I began to think, you know, the business of love is cruelty. I don't know if the business of love is any one thing. And as I say, nor did Williams, because in many other poems, he says the business of love is, you know, something else. The business of love is, you know, a love of nature. A business of love is building a great garden. You know, he has many different lines. I ended up using the line as a kind of almost a test case or a warning for what it can be like if you hold on to any one line about human beings. But I do like, I should say, when he says, "By our will, we transform to live together," this notion that cruelty and love maybe need not be. I mean, anyone who's been in love, I think, can associate, you know, because of its relationship to vulnerability, and because humiliation can so quickly follow on the heels of vulnerability, and because any situation where someone doesn't love you, which it may be essentially blameless, whom you love, may feel like a cruelty to you, even though it's not maybe technically intended to be a cruelty by the other person, or any of those things that attend love. I think that rather than thinking of them as, you know, opposites, as we tend to think of on a spectrum, I did like the way that the line brings them together and offers a notion of, as I say in the book, of an alchemical relationship between them, so that they need not be at polar ends of a spectrum, but actually can be transformed into each other, perhaps back and forth.
Maggie Nelson is the author of The Art of Cruelty, A Reckoning. She spoke with Steve Paulson. When you watch a movie about zombies taking over the planet, you could be just having a good time. Or you could be working out your existential angst and underlying sense of despair. Eugene Thacker teaches media studies at the New School in New York, and he's also the author of In the Dust of This Planet, Horror and Philosophy, Volume 1. In it, he argues that our world is increasingly unthinkable, and that it makes sense to look at the horror genre for help, since horror and philosophy have so much in common. As Thacker told Dan Strangchamps,
the boundary between the natural and the supernatural, for instance, which is an age-old boundary that's inherited largely from classical cultures, but also obviously from the history of religion. This is an ongoing interest both in horror and in philosophy. And fundamentally, what that's about is the question of whether the world around you, the world into which we're sort of thrown, is it? Is the world what you see, what you get? Or is there something else that's sort of beyond appearances or beneath the surface, either in terms of a deeper meaning for an individual or in terms of sort of sensing that there is a place for an individual or for humanity generally in the world?
Is the world safe because we can see what's there, or is the world terrifyingly unknown? There's a famous remark Stephen King made once, I think. He said, horror is the reason we don't like to sleep with our feet hanging out of the bed. It's about that fear of the unknown.
That phrase, the fear of the unknown, interestingly, is the definition that the American author H.P. Lovecraft gives to a tradition that he calls supernatural horror.
You mentioned Lovecraft. There's a famous short story by H.P. Lovecraft, which you write about a bit in your book, and I think expresses some of what we're talking about. It's the one called From Beyond.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe that one?
Yeah. It involves this sort of mad scientist-type character that creates a strange device. Lovecraft doesn't give it even a very detailed description of what this device is, but supposedly it enables a person to see what normally we cannot see, even into other dimensions. And Lovecraft here is very much influenced by quantum physics and relativity and stuff, which he was very interested in. As with many of Lovecraft's stories, what happens is that invariably the character goes mad, he goes crazy, because it's not something that the human being is built for, that kind of reception. And there's some great scenes where the character describes seeing these strange quasi-creatures that seem to have bodies, but that they're translucent, and they seem to even pass through him because they're from another dimension or something. So Lovecraft in stories like that is almost taking up quantum physics and then plopping it down into genre horror, and then you see what happens when he does that.
Well, I think the really creepy part about that story is Lovecraft's vision of this other world that's filled with these things that are sort of floating and misty and oozing. You know, there's nothing really definite. Why is that so horrifying?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting if you go back and if you just think about horror film and you look back at the history of horror film and the way that monsters or creatures are represented, there's something about the formless that seems to hit a nerve with many people. In part, it could be because philosophers such as Aristotle tell us that life is defined by form and being formed and having a boundary and an outline.
Well, speaking of ooze, that reminds me of another really sinister story that you write about. This one's by Fritz Lieber, and it's called Black Gondolier. Can you describe that one?
He does something very interesting in Black Gondolier. He imagines that oil is actually a kind of sentient entity, and that instead of human beings using oil for all these years as a source of energy, oil has actually been utilizing human beings for its own unknown sort of intentions and uses. And there's one character in that book who is fairly unreliable. He's sort of an autodidact and a little bit crazy and lives out by the oil fields all by himself. And he's a little bit paranoid, but has drawn together all these different branches of knowledge from the occult to physics and has come up with this revelation or this theory about oil as using human beings, actually. And Lieber wrote this, you know, a long time ago, but it's quite prescient today given our own global context.
Right. I think maybe the terrifying notion there is this notion that the world is really not about people. It's this very anti-humanistic notion. We walk around thinking we're the center of everything, but what if, in fact, we're nothing and the world has a whole different center? It could be other creatures, other beings are controlling us, or just that the world goes on without us and we are nothing.
Yeah, it's a really difficult thought, I think, to wrap one's head around, but I would also argue it's a really commonplace thought. All of us, each of us as individuals, have hopes and desires, and we do things to try to achieve certain ends. But all of us, even the most extreme control freak, knows that sometimes it just doesn't work out. There are things that are not in your control. And I think that those sorts of everyday feelings maybe that people have is something that is enhanced or magnified or maximalized in supernatural horror. To think about, well, what if the world is not simply the world in our image, which would be an anthropomorphic kind of view of the world, but also that the world is not made for our use and benefit, which is more an anthropocentric view, so that natural resources exist simply so that we can use them. And it's also even different from a misanthropic view. You know, I mean, there's also the view that the world hates us or it's against us or human beings are the enemy of the world. Even that's still a little bit humanistic because it's sort of like saying, at least the world takes enough to take notice, even though it doesn't like us.
Right. We matter.
Yeah, we matter, or the world notices. Writers like Lovecraft evoke this other alternative, which is really about indifference, or the world as anonymous or impersonal, or almost sort of indifferent to the things we try to do to change it or to mold it to our desires. And I think that's ultimately the real hard thing to think through.
So I have to ask you, what's the benefit to this kind of thinking? I mean, is there any way in which you can or you do use this to go through our lives?
Yeah, that's a question that comes up frequently when I give talks. And it's a difficult question because part of the project for me is also maybe asking us to re-examine how we think about these sorts of things, whether it's philosophy or horror or what have you, in the sense that we often, when we see something like this, want to know how can it help me or what should I do with it? And really that's sort of asking, how can I use that to attain a certain end or help me get through this? While I think you can do that, I also want to ask, is that the only way of looking at these kinds of works, whether they're examples in horror or philosophy? Particularly in philosophy, there's often that sort of question asked or that demand, and almost in a therapeutic or even a self-help kind of way, like how can this help me get through this particular issue? And I think there are examples in philosophy that address that. But I also feel like philosophy and horror as well, I mean, they ask more questions than they provide answers. And in fact, they make things worse usually because they make you realize you've been assuming these things all along that have no ground, for instance. And they're often like crisis-inducing more than problem-solving endeavors. But, you know, the question is there a value in that? And I don't know. I think that there is. And I think especially now, given that we are constantly encouraged to think about events on a global scale, but also on a non-human scale, these are areas, philosophy and horror, that might give us some ideas about how to do that.
You mean how to imagine a world in which the monster doesn't die?
Either how to imagine a world in which the monster doesn't die, how to imagine a world in which maybe there's no difference between us and the monster, how to imagine a world in which maybe just the world itself is a monster, or maybe being existing itself is a monster, or I don't know. I mean, how to think around these sorts of limits that are really absolute limits. They're not necessarily relative kind of limits.
Eugene Thacker is the author of In the Dust of This Planet, Horror and Philosophy, Volume 1. He spoke with Anne Strangechamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of the program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1030A, Horror. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Anne Strangechamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Special thanks to special guest engineer Brittany DeAnda. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.